It was fall, early fall. One of those dry, cold, bittersweet days I've never found anywhere except in North China. Exciting weather. Autumn in Peking. This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen, telling you a story. One I've told you before, over a year ago on one of the first of these broadcasts. This, by the way, is one of the last. It's the last, to be exact. I have 15 more minutes with you as an editorialist, and I'm telling you about a day in early fall in North China on the kind of day makes you look for an excuse to tell yourself that you're in love when just breathing is fun. You know, there aren't many of those days in one average lifetime. That's why I remember this one. I like to tell the story. I didn't fall in love. But on that wonderful spring day, I heard the first cry of a small Chinese citizen saying hello to the world. I saw his father's face at that breathless and beautiful moment. Just exactly then, I decided to be a father myself sometime. I left the Orient soon after that. I was back in the States, back in school, and I read in the papers what happened at the Marco Polo Bridge. The young Chinese father mentioned it in his next letter to me. "We're hoping there'll be a prompt end to this unpleasantness," he said. "Little Yu has cut his first tooth." Then the letters stopped coming, the years went by, and one day I was a father myself, just as I determined to be that distant autumn in North China. It was autumn. I said spring a minute ago. I'm a little upset because I'm saying goodbye to you all. Rebecca's mother, you know, had a birthday last week, and that got me to thinking of birthdays and mothers generally, and then about little you specifically, whose birthday, if my calculations aren't all cockeyed, belongs about here on the calendar. Because I've lost his address, and more importantly, because you has lost his address, I'm sending him here with, by radio, a birthday card. Dear you, and while no pun is intended, ladies and gentlemen, it really might be you. Dear you, much has happened in the world since you were born. You know what's happened in your part of it. Maybe you haven't had the chance to find out what's been going on over here. Well, since I left your house, we've had a depression and a great president who told us we had nothing to fear but fear itself and whom we believed. We tried to pretend that what was happening in your country was no concern of ours for a while, but then there came a day in December when we found out how wrong we were. After Pearl Harbor, we were in it all the way with you, and as you may have heard, we're still in China, taking sides in China, in your country. We won't discuss that matter in a birthday greeting or go into that civil war, but these are painful subjects. My purpose, you, is only to cheer you with a word of hope. You have the right to great hopes. So has everybody who is 15 years old today. Even if, like you, they've never lived in all those 15 years through a single day of peace. Happy birthday to you. As you've heard me say, ladies and gentlemen, this is Orson Welles making a kind of valedictory speech on his last 15-minute period in a year of weekly 15-minute periods, trying to sum up the things I've said in a year of broadcasting. I don't know that I've said much. It's a poor enough distinction, but I really think I was the very first among what are called liberal commentators to make vigorous criticism of Mr. Truman. At a time when his cheerful lack of equipment for his job was generally taken for a kind of humble charm, I had my Sunday pea shooter leveled steadily at the White House and at those boon companions from Missouri who are nowadays most frequently invited to the executive mansion. Good Democrats and liberals, my good friends, begged me to lay off on the grounds that I was contributing to a reactionary and Republican victory. It was my claim that Mr. Truman, before he was done, would make such a victory, such a certainty, that my little storm warnings wouldn't matter. I said that Mr. Truman would outwit his progressive apologists and make apologies impossible. From the start, I said he was reversing the Roosevelt domestic program and foreign policy, that he would inevitably betray organized labor and bring us to the brink of war. I take no pleasure in having been proved fairly right in this appraisal, and I really wish I'd been wrong. You know, I remember when the capital city of our country was remarkable for the good people who were going there. Now, it's remarkable for the good people who are going away. I remember when the best and brightest of young men were turning down big salaries to go up to Washington and work for low ones and for the love of serving our American government. I remember an experiment conceived and christened by another president. In the name of political expediency, the new president has scuttled the New Deal. But his and Mr. Roosevelt's political party has not been noticeably strengthened by this effort. Before the peace was prepared for it, Mr. Truman got rid of wartime controls. Mr. Truman has alternately endorsed and repudiated the same political speech. Mr. Truman has nominated a man for a job that wasn't vacant. He has quoted a conversation with a congressman that was never held. After the railroad unions postponed a strike on the strength of Mr. Truman's promise of further concessions from the railroad companies, Mr. Truman went ahead, seized the railroads, broke the strike along with his word, and called on Congress for a draft labor law. Another Truman promise was for a special session of Congress if the present price control law failed to keep prices down where they belong. The law's lousy. Your dollar buys you less every day. As a matter of fact, there's no real price control, and as a matter of record, there's been no special session of Congress. How about calling one? Mr. Truman says no. You know, there's a point in statecraft where the well-intentioned blunder turns into actual and public evil. Mediocrity can be a menace. In the day of the atom, an American president's mistakes are more than mere American embarrassments. His mistakes are wrongs against his government and its peoples, and against all the peoples of all the governments. You may have read in the papers that I'm suing a paper and also a man, suing them for calling me a communist. While I've still got a radio program, in the 3 or 4 minutes left to me as a broadcasting editorialist, I'd like to deal with that question. Well, of course, red is the easiest smear in the whole dirty palette of propaganda. If a man's ideas don't suit you, the simplest answer is to claim that he got the ideas from Moscow. That's the way of the witch hunters. The men who, for their own benefit, want to keep things as they are. They find a name to smear on everybody who wants to improve things. The improvements are always called dangerous foreign ideas. Tom Jefferson's ideas, for instance, were supposed to have come from France. The Americans who supported those ideas were called Jacobeans. In the same way, Franklin Roosevelt's reforms and Wendell Willkie's one-world outlook were called communistic. Improvement itself, any kind of improvement, is written down as alien. Well, as a patriotic American, I resent this effort by the reactionaries to hand to the Soviet Union leadership in the democratic cause. Now that the chance to broadcast these opinions of mine has been taken away from me, I'll venture to speak again on my last broadcast, an opinion on this hotly contentious matter of Soviet Russia, an unpopular opinion and one you've heard from me before. It's the fear of Wallace, of course. The conservative world is profoundly shocked at Henry Wallace's radical suggestion that we do not necessarily have to go to war. The liberal world ought to be shocked just as profoundly when one of its spokesmen comes out for a program of hacking up the globe into spheres of influence. My part in all this Wallace hoopla and rowdy-dow has been this single point, and since I'm repeating myself by way of goodbye, I might as well repeat my favorite formula for this issue of the red menace. I've said this many, many times before. I hope for the chance to say it again. We cannot fight communism and succeed. We can compete with communism and win that competition. An awful lot of hungry and unhappy people are sharing this earth with us. There's much of a share they have, these slaves and semi-slaves. They're beginning to ask for a better portion. Vyshinsky's hot and hasty eloquence, Gromyko's inexhaustible armory of quibbles are sometimes merely obstructionist, but mostly a part of an appeal by the Soviet Union to those slave peoples outside of the Soviet Union who are minded to break their chains and want somebody's help to do it. Now, what does Russia really want? Russia, as a nation, wants friendly borders. The only question is how deep the borders are going to be. Russia wants oil and seaports. There's no question that Russia is going to get her oil and her seaports, a sufficiency. Nobody's going to fight a shooting war over that sufficiency. Oil and seaports and friendly borders, a sufficiency, mind you, won't make Russia too big to live with. But mark this, Russia will be too big to live with, much too big, if she ever manages to persuade the undernourished, the diseased, the ill-housed, the freedom-yearning world majority that she speaks exclusively for them. We must offer the benefits and graces and the bread and butter of our democracy, our political capitalistic democracy, our real or imagined democracy, in practical competition with the benefits and graces and the bread and butter of Russia's socialism, Russia's authoritarian socialism, Russia's real or imagined socialism. In that practical competition, if our system doesn't win, then our system is not good enough to fight for. If in that open contest our way of life doesn't become by acclamation the way of the world, then it's not the Russian kind of government that can only prevail by force, it's ours. But of course, we know that to be nonsense. We know that ours is not a police state. And why should we use the tactics of the police state in our dealings with neighbor powers? We don't need to bluster and bully. We're the strongest nation the world's ever known. We're so strong, so invincibly, unbeatably strong that we don't need to sacrifice more of our youth to bloody battles in order to prove it. We're so strong, we don't have to fight to get our way. We're so strong, we don't even need to threaten. Our strength is threat enough. We're strong enough to be polite. We tower over the rest of the world in wealth and arms and health and optimism and everything that makes a nation great. We are the giant among nations. We are so very big, we can afford to be kind. We can be kind and get our way, as we must finally for this century at least, if there's a chance for peace. Only big, strong, rich, good America can make the peace and keep it. If there's a chance of war, only big, strong, rich, bad America can make that war. Well, I don't like armies and armaments. 80 cents, you know, 80 cents out of every one of your tax dollars goes to pay for them. In other words, for the war we've just lived through and the one we're just fixing to fight. I don't like guns. But I'm not one of those mystics who feel that if you've got a lot of guns, you've simply got to shoo them off. I don't believe in disarmament because I don't believe it works. I don't believe that by brandishing battleships and atom bombs at the Soviet Union, we can bully the Soviet Union into establishing a duplicate of our two-party representative government. I also don't believe that we can check the expansionist tendencies of the Kremlin by scrapping the battleships and distributing the atom bombs like Christmas baskets. I claim we're big enough to be kind, and I don't suggest that we should be so kind that we stop being big. I'll say it just once more. We should not fight. We should compete. We should compete because we're bound to win. We're bound to win because we're so big, and most importantly, because we've got so much to offer. Now, it's just about time to say goodbye. Maybe there's time enough for the letter I wrote the lady from Weehawken on the first of all these broadcasts. She wanted to know why, for heaven's sakes, I was going to be a radio commentator, and here's how I remember it, or the answers I tried to give her. It may sum up what I've been trying to say. Dear madam, there are no colleges for commentators. They just do it because they want to, and they go on doing it if the public doesn't object. I'm old enough to vote, and I can read. Someday that won't be enough to make a man an editorialist, but right now it gets me in. You may find me on an occasional soapbox, but I'll be speaking then in behalf of those notions which were first drafted into our Constitution and our Bill of Rights. As you've just heard, I don't happen to be a communist. I don't believe in suppressing communism by suppressing democracy. I think that encourages communism. An unbroken line of disillusioned Europeans day after day are marching into the Communist Party because we seem to be afraid of our own political principles. Somebody should tell our military governors that we've been having quite some success in most states with those principles at home for quite some time. We're now committed to moral as well as economic leadership in a world struggling out of the dark ages. We must not abandon our responsibilities any more than our fighting men abandoned their guns. The dazzling fact of this American peace calls for the same brave, big spirit which illuminated our part in the battle, the unbudgeted courage that bought the issue of that battle, the most terrible in all time. We have a little president, but we are not a little people. Madam, this is a great moment, the great moment in history. None of us, however humble, however inexperienced, can keep his silence if he can speak at all and live with himself. I hope I haven't preached at you. I've been here to interest you in things that happen to interest me, to start some arguments, maybe to stimulate some conversation. I've tried to keep you amused. I am always, and believe me, very, very sincerely and as ever, your obedient servant. That's the end of the letter to the lady in Weehawken and the end of all my broadcasts, a year of them to you. My thanks to you for listening and for all your letters, and my thanks to ABC for giving me this great opportunity. Until another series, which I hope comes someday, sometime, believe me, friends of the Democratic persuasion, I remain as always, obediently yours.
Take two on the aisle for the premiere of Is It Fact or Fiction? When the show that dares to challenge historical myths bows in this afternoon in just 25 minutes over most of these ABC stations. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.